number 06-1068, City of Portland, Oregon, petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Stevens for the petitioner, Mr. McDermott for the respondent.
If it please the court, and with the court's leave, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The rule that is challenged on this appeal was to be a product of negotiated rulemaking. As set forth in the Senate report on the 1995 amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act, which is found in the addendum to the agency's brief, and in particular at page 20 of that addendum, negotiated rulemaking is specifically encouraged by federal statute, and allowing the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency to set aside the carefully balanced structure that results from that negotiated rulemaking would be counterproductive and contrary to the statutory authorization under which the negotiation is constructed. The carefully balanced structure that was reached here by the agency with a federal advisory committee composed of representatives of water authorities, environmental organizations, included a provision that uncovered storage reservoirs did not have to be treated for cryptosporidium if state regulatory agencies concluded that an adequate risk mitigation plan was in place, a provision that was supported by entities like the American Water Works Association.
Well, what do you do with the statute? What do you do with Section 1B6C of the statute, which imposes very specific obligations on the agency here?
Which agency? Which
EPA.
Obligation? Which obligations, Your Honor?
Doesn't the statute bar the agency from using cost-benefit analysis at all?
We're not claiming on this argument that the agency used cost-benefit analysis to agree to enter into the agreement in principle that permitted a risk management alternative for uncovered storage reservoirs. If the court does wish me to address immediately the issue of cost-benefit analysis and whether
speaking for myself, it seems to me that's sort of the heart of the case.
Speak for at least two-thirds of us.
Right.
Yeah. Right. The Environmental Protection Agency argues in its brief that it is foreclosed from balancing the risks or benefits and the costs in deciding whether it should impose a certain treatment requirement. That's not what it did when it interpreted the statute in issuing the rule. As we state in our reply brief, the rule is based on a determination by the agency as to what the risks are in certain situations from this pathogen cryptosporidium and whether those risks justify a certain treatment, whether those risks or benefits. The authority, the agency, in its conduct in issuing the rule, interpreted the statute to permit it to do so, and it did so. It decided not to require filtered systems to use ultraviolet radiation as a treatment for cryptosporidium because it concluded the benefits did not justify the imposition of the costs associated with that treatment. It decided mistakenly.
Let me just ask you a question, at least to get focused on this. You tell me why this is wrong, okay? You don't challenge the zero MCLG, right?
Correct.
Okay. And you don't argue that the standard the agency set was not feasible, right?
It was
not
feasible technologically
to
build.
In other words, you don't argue that the standard they imposed was not feasible, correct?
The term feasible requires that cost be taken into account.
The statute prohibits the agency from taking cost-benefit analysis
The statute prohibits the agency from making a certain adjustment under a certain provision of the statute as a result of a formal cost-benefit analysis. EPA did not interpret, nor would it be rational to interpret the statute, to pay no attention to whether there are benefits to be achieved by the obligations it is imposing. They based
you didn't challenge the zero. You didn't challenge the zero standard, so, right?
We do not challenge the standard that it is a goal to achieve zero. Now, what may be done without being arbitrary and capricious to approach that goal is the crux of the case.
You say it's too expensive, therefore it's not feasible, correct?
We say...
Isn't that right? That's your position, right?
That is one of our arguments, Your Honor, that taking cost into account, it is not feasible. It is also an argument that was accepted by the agency.
So I'll just ask you one more time. What does 1B6C mean?
As interpreted by the agency in issuing the rule, it means that you do not make close cost-benefit judgments. You do not say that if the benefits are 40% less for a certain treatment technique and the costs are 60% less, then you're going to drop it down to 40%. It does not mean that you don't look at whether there is a benefit to be achieved by the obligations that are being imposed.
Yeah. I'm having, it's a difficult statute, and your argument is not, I'm not saying that you haven't done a good job, but it's not always pellucid what is being argued. Is it your argument that the restrictions in subpart, I guess it's 6C, that the administrator may not use the authority of this paragraph to establish a maximum contaminant level, stage one, stage two, is applicable only to the first stage of the process, that is to say the setting of the maximum contaminant level, and then that limitation on the use of cost-benefit goes away? Or is it your argument that at all stages, the prohibition on the use of cost-benefit is not absolute?
I must concede, Your Honor, that the statute does not say that it only that the provision applies only at the first stage. It has some effect at the second stage, but the agency's own interpretation is that it does not preclude it from taking benefit into account in deciding what requirements it will impose. But that is only one of our arguments on one of our two objections to this rule. And the first that I was urging is that the administrator entered into an agreement that uncovered storage reservoirs, agreement in principle, that included provision that uncovered storage reservoirs need not be treated for cryptosporidium as long as there were an effective risk management program in place. And an agreement that was approved by agencies that had previously favored covering uncovered storage reservoirs, indicating a recognition that what EPA acknowledges in it, that page 34 of its brief, to be a small number of remaining uncovered finished storage reservoirs were not bodies of water that resembled the lakes that had been found to present some perils, but rather were carefully engineered structures like the reservoirs operated by Portland and New York that presented no risks to the public health that could not be managed. And in these circumstances, the clear import of the agreement in principle into which the agency entered was that it would issue a proposed rule reflecting the agreement in principle, and that it would not alter that proposed rule unless new information came to its attention by way of comment or otherwise. And even in cases that do not involve negotiated rulemaking,
isn't there evidence in the record that open reservoirs are at risk even if the source of the water is treated? Isn't there evidence in the record that the source, that the reservoirs are still at risk?
There is evidence in the record that there are dangers from contaminants like bacteria or viruses
and birds
in uncontrolled storage reservoirs.
Birds also, right?
Yes, no evidence that, that birds shed infective Cryptosporidium oocysts that are infective to humans. There is evidence that...
But there isn't evidence in the record that there aren't studies that show that bird and small animal droppings contain Cryptosporidium?
There is evidence in the record, Your Honor, that Cryptosporidium could pass through a bird digestive tract.
Right.
There is evidence in the record that small animals...
And that that's, in fact, happened in open reservoirs. So why isn't that a sufficient basis for the agency to say a risk management system is not enough?
Two answers to that, Your Honor. The first is that none of that data relates to open storage reservoirs that are engineered managed structures like those operated by Portland and New York. Second, EPA was perfectly well aware of these studies showing
I was looking at my notes on this. You say none of them were storage facilities like Portland's?
Like, were engineered, managed facilities which can receive no runoff like Portland's or New York's. So,
what about the Stanley Levin Reservoir?
I'm not aware of that particular.
Fenced, not subject to runoff, and could only be contaminated by birds, like Portland.
I believe that was one of the studies that showed contamination by contaminants other than Cryptosporidium of uncovered reservoirs. But those studies were all before the agency when it elected to include in the proposed rule an alternative for uncovered storage rules.
So are you telling me that study didn't relate to Cryptosporidium that I just mentioned?
There was only one study, Your Honor, in the record that said Cryptosporidium had been found in uncovered storage reservoirs. That's referred to at great lengths in the briefs as the Le Chevalier 1997 study.
And one of them is this Levin Reservoir, which...
And I believe that it is stated in that study that those reservoirs, all of the reservoirs viewed in that study, resembled natural lakes in which they had runoffs.
That's the Stanley Levin one, at least maybe my notes are wrong. It says could only be contaminated by birds. It had no runoff.
I do not recall, Your Honor, that reservoir being one of the ones considered by Le Chevalier in his study.
Okay.
In any event, that study was before the agency when it entered into the agreement in principle that included the risk management alternative. And this court and others have taken pains to indicate that when EPA has departed from a proposed rule, it has done so based upon new information that came to it by way of comment or otherwise. In this situation, EPA does not even claim to have received any new information subsequent to the agreement in principle. It doesn't claim to have received any information other than by way of comments, and as to what it received by comment, those comments that opposed continuation of the risk alternative option were a minority of comments. They did not come from sources considered by the agency to be authoritative or even to be identified in most cases. But most important, they did not refer to one single scientific study, one single datum of information that had not been before the agency at the time when it entered into the agreement in principle, including a risk management alternative. In these circumstances, to permit the agency to set aside this agreement would, in the words of the Senate report, be counterproductive and contrary to the statutory authorization under which the rulemaking was negotiated. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, and unless the court would like me to address further questions now, I will reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. With me at council table is Carrie Whaling from EPA OGC. I think that the court focused immediately on the most salient point in this whole case,
and that is. Would you start with this point about the negotiated rulemaking?
Yes.
Let's just start there.
Yes, I think way too much has been made of the negotiated rulemaking. First, it's true that there was a negotiated rulemaking, but what that shows is that EPA involved a very broad community of interests in developing an agreement in principle. The agreement in principle said that there was great concern over open reservoirs. That concern had been around since the 1970s at least. The agreement in principle said one of the things that we are seriously considering is imposing a cover requirement. We also have the possibility of doing a risk mitigation plan that might stand in lieu of covers. Give me your comments on that. The first thing is that Portland spent much of its first brief saying that it had no idea that we were actually seeking comment on that. Well, it's clear that we were. We received comments. One of the most salient comments was, this doesn't make sense. How can you, at this late date, allow drinking water to come directly from open reservoirs where they are subject to everything from intentional contamination through tourism, through bird droppings, through rogue swimmers who cut through the fences? How can an agency allow that to persist? EPA considered those comments and decided that it would vary from the agreement in principle. I think the only way to interpret what Portland's saying is that the agreement in principle was essentially binding. Once you have an agreement of...
That's not exactly clear. I think they would say not that it's binding, but that you can't change it without it running under comment. You would have to give notice of your intent to change and then have further comment.
Yes, sir.
It's not saying you're wrong in your conclusion, but I don't think it's fair to style the argument as saying that it's binding.
Well,
Mr. Stevens was saying that more than other comments, you have to receive something that justifies the change.
Yes, I think their argument is severalfold. First, they say you have
their
to...
Their argument gets weaker when they make it orally than it did in the brief, but as I understood the brief, they were saying you had to...
Here's what I understand their argument to be. You have to put it out for comment. And they complain that, well, yes, you literally said, give me comment on it, but we had this aura of consensus. We were lulled into sleep. We had no idea that you actually really wanted comment on it. We thought this was a done deal. I mean, I think that is a preposterous notion. And
maybe I'm unfair to you to say that it's unfair.
I think it's a preposterous notion, and I think it would make the whole notice and comment provision a charade. I just think it makes no sense. But
look, the point of this, as it fits to my other argument, is that the comments submitted presented no new facts or analysis that justified amending the negotiated outcome.
Yes, that's the second step of their argument, sir.
Point here.
Yeah, that's, well, the first point I think is a very important point,
well,
because
Mr. Stevens was focusing on what I just said.
Yes.
Yeah.
Understood. My answer to that is that EPA put it out for comment and they received comments saying what I said before, which is that at this late date, it makes no sense to have open reservoirs be a source of drinking water in urban areas. EPA was not... I don't think there really was a new fact per se, but EPA, basically what EPA did was that it received a number of comments. A number of those commenters said what I just said. You should have these covered. EPA analyzed those comments and decided, in light of what they already knew, which was a 1997 study that shows that water degrades in open reservoirs, they said, you're right, commenters. We accept your comment. Your comment is well taken. I think it's a false notion to think, as Portland does, that there had to be some new study that says what Le Chevalier had already found in 1997. I think that's their complaint. EPA's...
They say facts or analysis. Is there some new analysis?
Well, yes. The analysis is that basically water degrades in open reservoirs. And
that was new?
I don't think it was... I don't think that was particularly new. No, that was old.
But was the negotiation a rope-a-dope? I mean, the agency knew all this when they went into the negotiation.
Yes. Well, I think that their argument would have a lot more credibility were not the first option in the agreement in principle cover the reservoirs. That was one of the options. The option wasn't, you know, these open reservoirs are probably fine, don't worry about it. The options were, number one, cover them. Number two, if you can show through a risk mitigation plan that you can get there from here, that you can show that these open reservoirs are not an obvious hazard, then that might be the way to go. EPA looked at it and said, well, wait a minute. We've thought harder about the risk mitigation option. We do not feel that we can be as protective, and that is our object here. This is the object of this statute, especially with regard to cryptosporidium, is to be very, very protective, prophylactic, precautionary. And the notion that I think EPA came to the realization that the first option, the cover option, is the option we have to go with. Portland's main argument about that isn't that there weren't comments on it. They think that the comments, in their mind, weren't persuasive. They were, for some of them were anonymous, some of them were not. Some of them were from, I think, the city, I think Colorado submitted comments. There was someone from the city of Cheyenne, NRDC. There were a number of groups, and they downplayed that.
Did you give them anything other than opinion that we would rather you did the first option? We think it's better that way.
Anything other than opinion?
Any new facts or data?
I don't think so. I think I would have to say it's the force of logic. And there's absolutely nothing in the case law that I'm aware of that says that an agency can vary from an agreement in principle and it based upon logic and policy decisions. But again, the agreement in principle specifically contemplated covers. As a matter of fact, in 1998, EPA had already told the regulated community in a rule that wasn't challenged that if you're going to build a new open reservoir, it has to be covered. That was the backdrop for the entire rulemaking. So I think that their argument on that is
let's turn to what the Judge Tatel thought was the core of the case.
Yes, sir. As I understand the question that you posed to Portland's attorney, it is, doesn't the statute make it very clear that even if you're correct that the benefits are nowhere near as great as EPA says, and even if the costs are much higher than EPA says, that ultimately EPA is specifically barred for cryptosporidium from making an adjustment to the rule. I don't think the statute could be any clearer on that point.
The statute could be clearer on every point.
The statute could be clear on, I would say, virtually every other aspect, but not on that one. I mean, that's one where you can see in the 1990s, Congress was legislating against the backdrop of a huge outbreak in Milwaukee. And I think it's fair to say that Congress said, never again for this particular pollutant, of all the contaminants in the world, that's the one, cryptosporidium. That's the one they focus on. And they said in there, do not adjust the rule.
A majority
is also adjusted by this rule. But say for cryptosporidium, they said do not make an adjustment. Do the cost-benefit analysis, which we did. It's long, it's detailed, they quibble with parts of it. Other parts they think are fine. New York City said it was a rigorous economic analysis. But in the end, their argument amounts to nothing more than, hey, the benefits aren't as great as you say.
But under your interpretation of the statute requires you to do an act that is of no value, right?
No, I wouldn't say that that's true. I think that's what Portland says. I would say that the cost-benefit analysis has some value. I don't think it's particularly a great value. It's informational.
Well, what's the value?
It's informational.
How is the information used?
The information could be used in a number of ways. It could be used by citizens. It could be used by entities such as Portland to make a decision about whether or not they're going to apply for a variance, mm-hmm. which they haven't done. Their citizens may be informed by this and say, you know what, we're persuaded.
So it can be used by anybody but the EPA?
They
can't use it.
They cannot use it to make an adjustment of the rule. And if that seems to be a rather odd formulation, what the statute says.
I'm wondering, if they can't use it to adjust the rule.
Correct.
Can they use it to set something in the first place, but they can't use it to adjust it once they've set it in the first place?
Well, essentially, yes.
I agree with Judge Ginsburg that this statute can be a lot clearer on everyone.
Yes. I would say it's rather striking that Congress wrote a provision like this. But they wrote it, and I think we have to honor it. And I think it does serve purposes, informational to Congress. But I think your question is it utilized in another way? Well, when EPA is going through essentially its feasibility analysis, EPA is trying to figure out what techniques are out there mm-hmm. that work. They have to be efficacious. Do they get us from point A to point B? They looked at it, they found, yes, there are techniques that are efficacious. Ozone, ultraviolet, they're currently being used by municipalities, they work.
We're getting a long way now from what the cost-benefit analysis can be used for.
Well, I'm saying, well, I guess what I'm saying is they do analyze the cost, because feasibility asks you to take that into account.
Yeah.
But those costs are utilized for a narrow purpose, and I think that's clear from the legislative history. Is this technique, once you decide it's efficacious, once you decide it's there and that it does work,
but you can use the cost-benefit analysis to make that first cut, the efficacious cut.
I don't think you're using the cost-benefit analysis directly. You're using elements of that information, I would say. That's probably fair.
I'm not sure that I understand the difference between using the analysis and using elements of that information.
I would say it this way. The critical analysis...
You can use part of it, but you can't use all of it? Is it?
But I would say that you're not doing a cost-benefit balancing. That's what you're not allowed to do. What EPA does, it thinks about the costs of the system. It has to decide, is it feasible? Does feasibility necessarily take into account cost? I would submit no. It takes into account whether it's efficacious or not. But Congress said, paren, including costs.
Would you like to back off on the statement that this is clear from Congress?
No, I'm not asking you to back off on your Here's all I want to say about the clarity. I think it's clear.
Don't try to defend the clarity.
I want to ask you.
You get to the point of saying you use a cost-benefit, but you can't do a cost-benefit balancing. You don't sound like you think it's very clear.
Well, I think it's very clear you can't do cost-benefit balancing.
Let me try to understand what you're saying by reference to the statute here for a minute, okay? All right. I'm looking at 1B3C1 and 1B3C2. Isn't that what we're talking about here? 1B, under your theory, 1B3C1 says you do use the cost-benefit analysis with the MCL, right?
Yes.
But not for the treatment technique, correct?
Indeed, that is what it says.
Okay. And the MCL is not being challenged here?
That is correct.
Okay. All right.
So that's, for me, that's just a really, I have several.
Why didn't you just say that?
I'm sorry, sir.
Why didn't you just say that?
Why did I just say that point?
Why didn't you say what Judge Tatel just said?
Right.
Well, I think actually my argument is really threefold.
Oh.
The first argument is that...
Onefold.
Why? I thought I understood.
I've got a lot of folds.
I thought I finally figured it out. You're saying I haven't? It's more complicated than this?
Basically, this is really what I'm saying. I'm saying that Portland's argument fails for lots of reasons. Okay, one of them, Congress said, don't do cost-benefit balancing when it comes to deciding how to issue a treatment technique. That part, I think, is clear. Congress also said, in the provision that you're talking about, when you do a cost-benefit analysis for a treatment technique, but you don't have to use it. They said that. The third thing they said, and that's... I'm sorry.
You're inferring that from the absence of the word use, right?
I think it's
a little curious, but that's...
I agree it is a little curious, but again, there's only so much one can do to look into the minds of legislators. I'm reading the words on the page. And
boy, besides, and we would have a much more complicated job if our standard review was whether it's curious.
And the third point I'd make is that even in the judicial review section, it says that it says a determination by the administrator that the benefits of a maximum contaminant level or treatment technique justify or do not justify the costs shall be reviewed by the court pursuant to a section. It says only if the regulation has been promulgated based on the determination. And that's the third point, is that EPA here did not ultimately base its determination as to this treatment technique on cost-benefit analysis. It based it on the fundamental premise that the techniques are out there. Ultraviolet radiation, ozone, covers. Those things all work, and they're not expensive for large municipal systems. To wit, $1 per household per month. I don't believe Portland disputes any of that.
Mr. McDermott, I want to go back one step to your point about the cost-benefit analysis not being used here, being barred from use here, actually. It says used for the purposes of paragraphs 4, 5, and 6.
I'm sorry, would you tell me where you're reading from?
B3C1.
That little I, the maximum contaminant levels?
Yeah.
Yes.
So when proposing a national primary drinking water regulation that includes an MCL, with respect to an MCL that's being considered in accordance with paragraph 4, and alternatives considered pursuant to paragraph 5 or 6A, publish, seek public comment on, and use for the purposes of 4, 5, and 6 an analysis of each of the following. 4 is the relevant one here, is it not?
I don't believe, well, 4 has some relevance.
Well, isn't it the one that governs the promulgation of an MCL?
Of an MCL, but this involves, what we have here is a promulgation of a treatment technique.
Okay. Let me see if I can trace this through or not. Well, this is just too complicated to do.
Unfortunately, I don't believe Portland's brief will help you decide that, because I tried to follow.
It really deals with what I was trying to get at.
Yes, part of that problem is that in its opening brief, Portland doesn't even address what I think is the linchpin for the whole case, which is the statement by Congress that EPA is not to address cost benefits and adjust a rule based on cost benefits in the context of cryptosporidium treatment techniques.
Yeah,
there's no mention of that in the opening brief, so I didn't even respond to these arguments about subsection 4
sort
and 5.
Sort of brings me back, though, your phrasing is careful and correct, that Congress should not use it in adjusting a level. That you seem to each time phrase it in a fashion that seems to leave it open for other uses. When I try to find out what you think it is open for, I'm not really getting a very clear answer as to, and maybe there isn't one, but.
You're prescribing a treatment technique.
Correct. That's what we're doing here.
Why is that adjusting a level?
Yeah.
Within the prohibition on
right.
adjusting a level.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. Could you say that again? I'm not sure I followed
you're
you.
You're prescribing a treatment technique.
Correct.
You're saying you can't use cost-benefit analysis to adjust a level. Why does
Correct.
It follow that you also can't use it to prescribe a treatment technique? Those are two different intellectual exercises, two different regulatory acts on the part of the administration. One of them you cannot use the cost-benefit analysis for. How does it necessarily follow that you also cannot use it for the other one, prescription.
I don't think the statute says don't use it for that. I think what the statute does is it gives you the roadmap for how you are to come up with a treatment technique.
Why?
And cost-benefit isn't one of them.
Why isn't you have me completely confused now. I thought your answer to the question Judge Sintel just asked would have been 1B6C.
Correct.
Which says MCL or treatment technique. Right?
Correct.
Well,
That's not what you said.
It says establishing an MCL or treatment technique. You can't use a cost-benefit analysis.
Correct.
Isn't that the answer to the question we've been asking you?
Yeah.
Well, that raises another problem. Are you making that argument?
Is that right?
I'm not sure what the problem is.
Well, are you making the argument? Then we'll get to the problem. We don't need to do it.
Okay, I'll state the argument.
Yeah,
tell me
else?
If it's wrong. Okay, the argument is the statute prohibits you from the agency from using a cost-benefit analysis to moderate or change an MCL or a treatment technique. And I would rely on that.
Specifically, a treatment technique requirement for the control of
cryptosporidium. Yeah, of cryptosporidium.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 1B6C. Now, is that wrong?
No, that's right.
Is it correct?
Yes.
Okay, now what?
What is the authority of this paragraph that you say that this prohibits you using in setting a treatment technique for cryptosporidium? Whatever it is, you can't use it, but what is it?
What is the authority that this paragraph...
The term,
the authority of this paragraph.
The paragraph is paragraph 6, additional health risk reduction and cost considerations. It's 6A. Saying that basically, as I understand the statute, it says do a cost-benefit analysis, and you can make an adjustment in certain situations. But if it involves cryptosporidium, you cannot make an adjustment based upon the outcome of a cost-benefit analysis.
But you still have to do a cost-benefit analysis.
Correct. You still have to do it.
See, your problem is you're not willing to admit that Congress just ordered the agency to do an act that it doesn't need to do.
Congress,
so what, right?
My problem is that Congress might have ordered them to do an act that they don't have to do.
No,
I'm sorry, what's your question?
Ordered you to do a cost-benefit analysis, but then prohibited you from using it.
I don't have a problem.
When it comes to setting a treatment standard.
Yes, I don't have a problem with that. That's what it says.
I thought you were trying to say there were other ways it could be used. You were trying to justify what Congress had done by saying, well, look, it's not silly. There are other ways it can be used. It can be used by the public. It could be used by Portland. But Congress didn't have that in mind, did it?
I honestly have no idea. I think it's very difficult to understand why Congress does something that they do. I mean, the legislative history is not exhaustive on it.
Well, didn't it happen because of the Milwaukee event?
Correct.
Isn't that what happened here? I mean, this wasn't exactly a rationally constructed statute from the beginning, right?
I don't know if I would. I don't know if there's any congressman in the room. I don't know if I would agree with that proposition. Does Congress act? It's that question. What does Congress act rationally? I don't know. I think it's in this context. I think it's a reasonably rational decision. There were hundreds of thousands of people that were ill in a city.
I wasn't saying the decision was irrational.
Oh.
I was saying that when we look at, I guess I'm trying to help you out here.
I'll take it.
Doesn't the oddness of the statute reflect the fact that it was amended in view of what happened in Milwaukee, right?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
The consequence of that is that you have this odd situation where the agency is prohibited from taking cost-benefit analysis into account, but yet required to do a cost-benefit study.
Yes. That's odd.
Yeah.
I don't find it
complicated. Is it any more complicated than that?
No, not really. No, and I think it's very basic, and that's why I was struck by the fact that Portland's opening brief doesn't even touch on this issue at all. And the first time that they touch on it is in their reply brief, and I think under your Waukesha case, that entire line of argument by them should not be considered. But shouldn't be given a lot of weight anyway, because I don't think it's particularly lucid how they try and work with the subparagraphs. I don't know if there's any other points you would like me to address.
I really hate to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Yes.
I'm going to take you back to the agreement in principle.
Yes.
Did the agreement in principle commit the agency that they would only make changes based on new information that required to show the need for revised or additional measures?
No, I don't.
Part of the agreement in principle.
No, I don't believe it is. No.
It's not.
No, I believe that the only way.
I have notes that say that was in there, and I don't have a reference as to where it was.
I think you know, common sense should prevail in a situation like this.
No. Common sense can't tell me whether or not that was in the agreement.
The precise wording, my recollection of the wording is that EPA stands by the agreement in principle, but if it receives comments, it will consider comments on the agreement in principle, and it can vary the outcome based upon that.
Would be important as to whether it says new
I could get you the precise wording. I believe it's JA 123.
Okay.
This is contained in the Federal Register. EPA will consider all relevant comments submitted concerning the stage 2 DBPR and visceral notice of public rulemaking, and in response to such comments will make such modifications to the proposed rule and preamble as EPA determines as are appropriate in issuing a final rule. I don't see how it could be otherwise, frankly, because
that's fine.
Yes,
that's somewhere on page 123.
It's in the column 2 towards the bottom.
Okay.
Subparagraph 2. And I don't see how it could be otherwise, frankly, but in any event, it is a little bit ironic that Portland is standing so much behind the agreement in principle, since they challenged the treatment requirements of the rule, and yet they signed on, the city of Portland specifically signed on to that notion that the waters would be treated. When I raised that in my brief, the response was, well, it was just a representative of the city of Portland. It wasn't really Portland. And I frankly don't understand that point, but
yeah,
so.
Thank you, gentlemen. I want to take you back now to where we were last on the authority.
Okay.
So we were reading 6C. Okay. The administrator may not use the authority of this paragraph to meet the setting of treatment technique for crypto. And you said that authority was the authority to what, base his decision on cost-benefit analysis?
To adjust.
To adjust.
Correct. Having decided that something is feasible, yes.
The authority, I think, is described as follows. Notwithstanding paragraph 4, this is in 1B6A, notwithstanding paragraph 4, if the administrator determines, based on an analysis conducted under paragraph 3C, that the benefits of an MCL promulgated in accordance with paragraph 4 would not justify the cost of complying with the level, the administrator may promulgate an MCL for the contaminant that maximizes health risk reduction benefits at a cost that is justified.
Yes.
That seems to be the authority that may not be used in the setting of crypto treatment. Right?
I think that's right, yes.
But that's not, that doesn't say you can't use cost-benefit, do a cost-benefit analysis. It says you can't, you cannot, if the cost, if, on the contrary, it says if the costs don't justify the benefits here, you can promulgate an MCL that maximizes health risk reduction benefits at a cost that is justified.
Yes. Did you think I was...
Just say you can't use cost-benefit analysis. The authority here is not to do cost-benefit, it's to make this particular type of adjustment.
I think the fair reading of the statute is to say, this provision seems to say to me that if EPA finds out that the costs and benefits are out of alignment and needs to make an adjustment to the treatment technique or MCL, it can do so based upon the cost-benefit analysis. And then you get to Section C, and it says, however, that will not fly for cryptosporidium. Don't make an adjustment. I guess your point is, can they somehow utilize the cost-benefit analysis?
It says what you can't do. It says first, yes. It says what you cannot do, and then
yes.
It says what you should do in that circumstance, right?
Well, it's certainly fair to say that EPA, I think the best reading of the statute, and on this point it isn't pellucid, but I think the best reading of the statute is that EPA is required to do a cost-benefit analysis. I think that is fair enough. But I think that a fair reading of this provision is that EPA shouldn't then utilize that cost-benefit analysis to adjust a treatment technique if it finds that treatment technique is feasible. Can it use the cost-benefit analysis in some other, in other realms? I don't think either party particularly briefed that. It may be that it can. I don't think that point, though, is a vital point for our analysis.
I think what you just said does help clarify.
Okay. The only other thing I would say is that ultimately, this rule really does rely on common sense. I think if you look at the notion that in 2007 you can have an open reservoir that birds defecate in, that rogue swimmers have gone in, there's a history of that, that a human body was found in, I think the notion that you can continue not to cover that, given that these are being covered all over the country and being phased out all over the country, that flies in the face of common sense. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Very briefly, if the court please, Judge Tatel, the Stanley Levine Reservoir was one of the reservoirs studied in the Le Chevalier study. We have read all but one portion of the article during counsel's argument and do not see any reference to its being subject to runoff. The one portion we could not read is an illegible box at the bottom of page 19, so we can make no representation as to what appears there. In response to counsel's statement, the agreement in principle, which appears at page 123 of the joint appendix, did not state any, which and subsequent, did not state that EPA was seriously reconsidering the risk management option for uncovered storage reservoirs, and it would have been a violation of the agreement in principle for it to say so there. I think I can actually.
What would have been a violation of the agreement in principle?
They agreed to issue a proposed rule that reflected these, the carefully bargained agreement that was reached.
What do you say is the effect of that provision 2.7?
2.7, the clear implication of it is they can change based upon comments.
Yeah.
And here there is no basis for any change based on any comment they received. Now, they simply did not do a cost-benefit analysis for the treatment technique for uncovered storage reservoirs. Not a question whether they used it. They simply didn't do it. They identified no benefits associated with it. And we can actually discern in matters that are of record why Congress did some of these apparently incomprehensible things. It required that a cost-benefit analysis be done for all treatment techniques, including those for cryptosporidium. And at page 14 of the addendum to the agency's brief, it states that an important purpose in doing that was an educational purpose, in addition to action purposes for the agency.
But even if you're right, why would that have affected? Wouldn't that just be, okay, let's assume you're completely right and they should have done it for that. What difference does it make for the outcome of this case? Because they couldn't have used it to change the otherwise feasible treatment technique.
They could have used it in deciding whether they're going to implement a treatment technique.
Okay.
At all.
Also, there is an explanation why Congress put in the prohibition on adjustment of a treatment technique for two contaminants and two contaminants only. It was not, and the two contaminants were cryptosporidium and disinfection byproducts. This appears at page 21 of the addendum to counsel's brief. It was not that the Congress considered cryptosporidium some overwhelming peril. It was that Congress understood that the agency had been in negotiation as to investigations and remedies that were to be proposed.
Can I go back to your answer to...
Is there evidence of that?
It's stated in page 21 of the addendum, which is in the Senate report.
That's the
addendum to the agency's brief.
It's the legislative history.
Yes.
Well, let me just go back to your answer to my question. You said to me that they could have used the cost-benefit analysis to decide whether to do a treatment technique?
Yes. Because they did.
Well, the statute says they may not use the authority of this paragraph to establish an MCL or treatment technique requirement, right?
It does, Your Honor.
Well, isn't an MCL or a treatment technique their only option? They have
yes.
to do one of them, right?
Yes.
So you're saying
perhaps
they have to do an MCL or treatment technique. Now, so where would they use the cost-benefit analysis?
They cannot use a formal cost-benefit analysis to adjust or establish a treatment technique. They may take benefit or cost, benefit and efficacy into effect in deciding whether to implement a treatment technique at all. If they identify...
Do they decide between whether to do an MCL or a treatment technique?
No, in deciding what to do, whether to do either. If a treatment...
Deciding between not doing anything and doing...
Doesn't the statute require that they do one of them?
Well, they certainly didn't do it because, as I said in my initial argument, that ultraviolet radiation that they're requiring of unfiltered systems is perfectly feasible for filtered systems as a...
And then maybe that was illegal, too. I mean, that doesn't affect whether...
Well, in that case, as we say in our reply brief, if they really want to urge this point, then the rule has to be vacated for that reason.
I thought we were talking about unfiltered systems here.
We are, Your Honor, but for the first time in their brief, the agency said something they'd never said in the entire course of the rulemaking, which is they can't take benefit into effect in deciding whether they're going to institute a treatment technique. Since they took benefit into account in deciding whether they would... require filtered systems.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe whether that was legal or illegal is irrelevant to the question before us today. This is unfiltered systems. Maybe what they did with filtered system was illegal if they took cost-benefit analysis into account, but that doesn't affect what it did here.
If the rule is in large part based on a patent illegality, then I would not think the court would allow it to stand. One crucial point. There is no indication whatsoever that the agreement in principle was based on a cost cost-benefit analysis, whether that's impermissible or not, and a variance that council referred to is not an option. The agency has said it would, of course, you would have to comply with their flawed risk assessment, and they've expressly said they doubt anyone would be able to make the necessary showing. It's a gate that's already been barred. Thank you.
Thank you. Stevens, Mr. McDermott, thank you. The case is submitted.